This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. You may have read the phrase, the Internet of Things, but what does it really mean? To put it simply, the power of the Internet to be in all of the regular objects that we use today. For example, what if your umbrella were able to tell you when you'd need it, or your prescription bottle lit up when it was time for you to take your pills? These things already exist, and our next guest not only helped develop them, but he's willing to bet that the real future of the Internet is an array of connected things, not the slab of glass that is in your pocket. David Rose is an entrepreneur and instructor at the MIT Media Lab, specializing in how digital information interfaces with the physical environment. His new book is called Enchanted Objects: Design, Human Desire, and the Internet of Things. And David, welcome to Word of Mouth.
It's great to be here.
So what is an enchanted object?
Well, I believe that we need a new type of relationship with our technology. You know, today we have these glass slabs that we all carry around, these smartphones or phablets or tablets in our pocket, and they're incredibly demanding of our attention. We seem to be glued to them most of the day. And because of that, it really diminishes the moments that we spend with others in the world. And the vision for an enchanted object is when all of the apps and all of the things that we do with our phones leap off of the screen into everyday objects. And the result is a much simpler, much more tangible, an interaction with technology that's really preferable over this convergence device.
So what might an example be of something that we use now? I guess I'm thinking of the Fitbit.
Right. Well, rather than having to go to an app to see how many steps you've gotten, instead you can just wear a bracelet. I'm actually wearing one right now that shows you through five little LEDs sort of how many steps you've taken today. And so that's an example of really simplifying an interface and embedding it into an everyday object, in this case jewelry. And enchanted objects will be, almost – It's hard to imagine things that won't be connected. You know, we have examples of there's a tennis racket that has an accelerometer in it, which basically measures how well you're hitting, where you're hitting, whether it's a forehand or backhand shot. You know, these things are getting embedded into sports equipment, into jewelry, into furniture. I have a Facebook coffee table sitting in the middle of my living room that allows me to sort of see in a very passive way the photos that friends are taking, because the Facebook coffee table listens to the conversation. And when I mention people or places that appear in photos, it sort of gradually shows those photographs in the middle of the living room.
I've also watched a really charming video of you at your home with your son looking over the Google Maps in your coffee table.
Yeah, that's right.
Lots of information in your coffee table.
I think that's sort of that's the promise of an enchanted object, is you take all of these services and all of these apps, and you can sort of have the best version of them. You know, you can have a map that's quite large, or a Skype connection between my kid and my parents that they can just access simply by opening a cabinet. So we have this Skype cabinetry, which offers a dedicated connection, which just means they talk much more frequently.
So these all sound like objects of the future and, I guess, present in your home. But you point out that there are enchanted objects that we've looked to in the past. The barometer is one that you mention.
Right. When I was growing up, I grew up in the Midwest in Madison, Wisconsin. My father, who's a physician, had sort of a ritual that he would perform every morning. He would get up and leave their bedroom, and on the way to their bathroom with his towel wrapped around his waist, he would tap this beautiful old brass barometer and sort of see which direction the barometric pressure was trending. And as a designer, I was always admired that incredibly simple interaction paradigm of, it's just an object. It's always on. It's always showing information that's relevant. It gives you the change in that information. Like, what a simple, delightful, intuitive experience. You didn't need to ever upgrade the apps. It never made you feel stupid. It was a beautiful object that sort of fit into the home. So, it had this sort of sense of adornment to it. So I hope that we can design interfaces that are just as lovely and that we appreciate having around in our lives as that sort of barometer.
Well, the word enchanted brings up thoughts of what is magic or mystical, but it is really just technology and circuits and programming and software, is the idea that we don't really know how it works. It just presents.
Yeah, I recently did a workshop at the Copenhagen Interaction Design Institute with a magician, and the students took everyday objects, in this case from IKEA, and made them enchanted. So there was a magic lantern that would listen to the story that you're telling your child and display lighting effects like thunder and lightning. There was some shades that knew if you were in front of them, and they would open or close based on whether you needed privacy or more sunlight. So these are, you know, everyday objects that have a sense of what you need and can take care of you.
You have those in your own home, according to the video I watched. You know, your shades are going up as you're pouring your coffee. Your son's having this conversation with a presumed grandparent inside of this
yes.
cabinet. But what happens to an enchanted house when the power goes out? As we saw during Hurricane Sandy, New York, New Jersey, all of these big city areas that were dependent on power for everything, from charging their phone to gas pumps, was gone.
Right. Well, I mean, I think one of the things you learn from interacting with magicians is that they don't reveal the mechanism of the trick. You know, things are more enchanted if they just work and always work, and you don't need to know all of the circuitry and all of the whether it's connecting through the Wi-Fi network or through the phone or through the cellular network. And I think increasingly, to address your power question, I'm working with a company called Sunsprite, which is making a little clip, almost like a tie clip or button, that detects whether you get enough bright light in the morning, so that your mood improves, and it also resets your circadian rhythm, so you're more likely to sleep, to get a full night's sleep. And what's nice, what's really magical about that device is you never have to charge it. It has a little piece of solar, a little photovoltaic recharger on it, like those old calculators did. And so you never have to plug it in and you never have to charge it. So, like, that's really magical if these things just work and can harvest power either from the sun or from movement, then you never have to worry about power outages.
So we're kind of imagining this place where all of our objects work together. It's kind of Jetson's home in my mind. Those 1950 commercials about the home of the future and these enchanted systems. But where is, you know, the Rosie the robot that we've been promised for years and years? Is this the enchanted object taking the place?
Well, in the book, I talk about six different aspirations that have been revealed through fairy tales or through the Jetsons or through Bilbo Baggins and The Hobbit, or, you know, sort of fantasy stories or science fiction. And I try to organize the coming Internet of Things into these six buckets. And they are omniscience, the interest in being all-knowing; telepathy, connecting to other humans; safekeeping, like protection; immortality, having a long and quantified maybe life; teleportation, sort of friction-free travel; and creative expression, that is the ability to play and to learn in a new way. Those are all aspirations that are revealed through narratives, you know, through fiction, through myth. And I think those are the things that we should work on as inventors and innovators to try to satisfy those age-old desires.
Those human desires and drives are aspirations, things that are bringing us forward. What is your sort of nightmare of the future?
Well, I teach at the Media Lab, and there are lots of different ways to envision our relationship to technology. You know, the glass slab that I talk about is one future, one where we have this call and response relationship to technology and we're sort of lost in our screens. Another future is when everything becomes wearable. And I think that's sort of a nightmare future, because you remember when we all would wear headphones and listen to different music, and that really cut us off socially from other people? If everyone's wearing a headphone and listening to something different, it's hard to interact with other people. Just imagine what happens when everyone's wearing a Google Glass-like display and seeing a different view of reality. Another future that I also think is a nightmare is one where the technology isn't located in and on us, but it's distributed into social robots. The robotics community really wants to believe in robots that have human likeness, that have the same ambulatory, you know, can walk around, can interact with us just like we interact with other people. And the more that we get closer and closer to human likeness, the more that we'll be creating things that appear to us as zombies or the old Jewish folklore Gollum. Hmm. And the more that they will threaten our own humanity and we won't want to live with them. So I think that's another nightmare future is human-like robots. So I think that really the most preferable future is when we have this huge array of tools, of things that we ordinarily use in the world that all get imbued with a little bit more intelligence. And that's sort of where I hope computers will go.
But what about our concerns about data? You know, all of this is based on data. Do you have any concerns about what happens to that information in this era when data privacy has been compromised in so many ways?
Yeah, I think it's a great point and an important thing to be worried about. I certainly when we designed the Vitality GloCap, we imagined that there are lots of reasons that other people might want to participate in the knowledge of whether people took a medication or didn't take a medication. But we made all of those services an opt-in. So the first principle is don't make it a default in and then an opt-out, but instead make it the inverse, which is if you want an email to go to a loved one every week that shows whether you did or didn't take a med, like my GloCaps, I share data with my father and he shares his data with me. So we can give each other a helpful nudge if we're not doing very well. And so people don't have to do that. If you don't want the data to go to a doctor, you don't have to. If you don't want the data to go to a pharmacy to facilitate an automatic refill of that medication, you don't have to. So I think, you know, the first principle is be clear and make everything an opt-in. I think an important second principle that my industry needs to do a better job at communicating and providing is an absolution button. With my Nest internet-connected thermostat, I should be able to say, forget everything you ever knew about me.
Hmm.
You know, like stop learning, because that some of these objects are all about learning you so that you don't have to learn it, but it can learn you over time and it can take care of you over time. But you should be able to just clear its memory. You know, every world religion has a metaphor for absolution. Mm-hmm. It's mostly about a forgetting, right?
Right.
And these objects should give you forgiveness / absolution / lobotomize, you know, so you can start afresh.
David, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks, Virginia. I've really enjoyed it.
David Rose is an entrepreneur and instructor at the MIT Media Lab, and he specializes in how digital information interfaces with the physical environment. His new book is called Enchanted Objects: Design, Human Desire, and the Internet of Things. Now, you can find a link to watch a short video of David in his home from the New York Times at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. You know the old saying, one man's trash is another man's treasure. Well, for passionate collectors, that holds especially true. Our next story illustrates the old maxim quite literally and comes to us from McSweeney's monthly program, The Organist.
My name is Nathan Salzberg. I'm the curator of the Alan Lomax Archive. In late March 2010, I got a phone call from a friend here in Louisville that a friend of a friend had been on a dumpster job that afternoon and had brought home from that job a few boxes of 78 RPM records. Knowing that I have an interest in music of the 78 era, which is roughly the late teens to the early 40s, he called me and I was lying on the sofa, sort of not interested in going out that night. But I got up off the sofa and I drove over to the house and there were maybe 15 boxes of 78s on the floor and filled with, you know, 20, 25 78s a box. The stuff was never really built to last to begin with, and folks who bought the stuff often didn't hold on to it or didn't treat the records well, so they haven't survived. But I didn't have my hopes up, but I started looking, and right away I started seeing these names like, you know, Carter Family, Uncle Dave Macon, Jimmy Rogers, the big stars of the era. But as I kept going, I started seeing rarer and rarer records. And then I found a Mississippi John Hurt record. I mean, as a friend told me in the other room, I went pale and just said, we have got to go to this house. Like, we've got whatever, wherever the rest of these records are, we have to get them now.
those daily.
They had gotten the contract to clean out this house of a fellow whose name was Don Wall. And it was obvious that this guy had a considerable record collection of vernacular music from the 20s and 30s.
Please don't take my life. I got two little babies and a darling loving wife. That bad man.
So six of us piled into two cars. We drove out to Preston Highway on sort of the lip of the south end of Louisville. There was a full moon, and under the full moon, we dove into the dumpster, pulling out maybe 30 boxes of 78s. A friend of mine went in headfirst and came up with ketchup on his brow. There were all these bottles of family-sized ketchup in the dumpster. We weighed down two pickup trucks pretty well and then drove back to the house where my friends had been hanging out and proceeded to dig through some of the records. But apparently there were all these records left in the house. So I went home that night and I slept a very fitful night's sleep. And I woke up at about dawn the next day and waited until a decent hour to call the dumpster guy. I think I called him around 8. And he said, by all means, come out to the house this afternoon and anything you can take will be something we don't have to lug out. So that afternoon, I drive out to Preston Highway and they let me in. They give me a dust mask and I go downstairs and the place is just a disaster. I mean, the guy just lives in squalor. And I just sit in to carrying boxes up and just box after box after box after box upstairs. Things were coated in mold. I didn't have gloves on and my hands were just completely black. This was recorded in 1927 in Atlanta by a group called the Georgia Crackers, which was a couple of brothers named Paul and Leon Kofer and their friend Ben Evans, who played the guitar. And they were sons of a sawmill operator and also a hymnal compiler. And they learned their tunes, by and large, from their dad's sawmill men. Tony Russell, who really is sort of the world's expert on this stuff, had the very best description of this band, and he called them the sound of a band playing on the precipice of disintegration. When you hear a record like that, and especially when you've listened to country music from the 50s through the 70s, even outlaw music sounds like almost sounds like chamber music compared to that. I mean, that just sounds like it's totally hell for leather. It's like falling apart at the seams. They sound like they're racing to get the song in before the record ends. They know they only have about 3 minutes. Ultimately, we found the collection consists of, about 2,500 items in what we call the Don Wall collection now. 99% of them are hillbilly records. So there's all of this just phenomenal and extremely rare string band material, all from all of these places, like, you know, in rural Tennessee and Kentucky and Virginia and North Carolina. What's great about the recordings made in the 20s and 30s is they were often made, not always, but they were often made locally. There were field recording sessions set up, and it just flushed out all of these just phenomenal, I mean, really characteristic local artists that had local styles that sounded like where they were from. Donald Pickett Wall, 75, died March 23rd. He left behind a brother, two nephews, and a niece. Cremation was chosen, and there was no funeral.
I have heard of a land on a faraway strand. Tis the beautiful home of the soul.
And that story was produced by Matt Frassica for The Organist. Word of Mouth returns, we're going to hear about a proposal for how to relegate machines. Who should govern robots? We'll explore that question when Word of Mouth continues.